This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Bridget Fielder about her new book, Relative Races, Genealogies of Interracial Kinship in 19th Century America. Welcome to the show, Dr. Fielder.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I am so glad that you're here and that we get to talk about this book. I am really excited about this book and the work that you do. To start us off, I wonder if you would please tell us about yourself.
I specialize in 19th century U.S. literature, increasingly early African-American literature, theories of race and gender. I sometimes work on children's literature and childhood studies. I work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Could you tell us a little bit about your own academic path that got you from where you started to where you are now?
I started taking early American literature classes as an undergraduate and promptly dropped American Lit 1 and throughout my whole major. And majored instead in philosophy and religious studies. And then I did a master's degree in theological and religious studies. And that whole time I worked in different ways on 19th century literature, though not American literature. And it wasn't until I did a master's degree in English that I was kind of finally drawn towards U.S. literature as a place of specialization. I actually started my PhD at Cornell thinking that I would do Victorian literature or maybe transatlantic literature and just ended up in the U.S. 19th century, I think in part because of the interdisciplinarity and just capaciousness of the field that didn't seem as tightly bound to specific literary genres, where transatlantic connections could be explored and where even periodization what was allowed to extend beyond the boundaries of a century and what we call the long 19th century, which ends up being kind of as long as one needs it to be, as many of these ideas are still ongoing. And it was really in my studies in U.S. literature that I came to African-American literature before 1900 as something that I didn't have in my previous educational formal training, going to predominantly white institutions, which was kind of conspicuously absent from my previous classes in literature, and realizing what a rich and interesting and exciting field African-American literature was, learning how exciting American women writers were particularly people who weren't very well known in kind of popular conversation, really kind of opened up that field for me as a graduate student kind of late in the game.
And what inspired you to write this book?
Just the kind of array of texts that I was reading, and I found myself compelled by a kind of odd array of texts in which I initially kind of struggled to describe what was happening in them. And so, really this book came out of a number of questions in which I would read something and say, what's going on here? Like reading William Allen's narrative of Mary King and saying, it's interesting that they compare her to this mixer's heroine in Uncle Tom's Cabin. What's going on with that? And how can one explain, what's happening here? And those questions, and trying to answer those questions and really, just kind of realize what was happening, really what led me to the book.
So would you describe your field as American studies then? You have such a broad background, and it sounds like for your intellectual hunger, there was no one department that was going to satisfy it. And so you intentionally sought out different fields of study throughout your higher ed.
My work is really strongly influenced by an American studies approach to American literature, though that approach was pretty, pretty central in thinking of how U.S. literary studies was approached in classes in early and 19th century American literature at Cornell, where I got my degree. And so there was really kind of always, the availability of interdisciplinarity in those classes that were, tied to other fields like American Indian studies and like gender studies. There was an American studies program in which courses were cross-listed. But those kinds of conversations with historians, with people in political science, with people in ethnic studies fields like African-American studies were really in many ways just kind of part and parcel to the courses that I took there and kind of what other people did and what I kind of realized was possible when doing U.S. literary studies.
So they really encouraged you to do this. It sounds like you found the right place for the kinds of questions you were going to be asking that couldn't be satisfied in just one discipline.
Yeah, well, I was really also very, very privileged to have strong advisors in that program and an array of peers who were interlocutors. Who worked in, the American 19th century kind of broadly, but who all did different things and brought, different interests to their work. In getting to know people in 19th century U.S. literary studies in general, I found people who were also engaging kind of broadly in interdisciplinarity in African-American studies, in gender studies, and study of American women writers, and children's literary studies.
And your current job allowed some space for you to write this particular book. If I'm understanding the acknowledgments correctly, there was a fellowship, there was time to really dig into this project and produce this book. Is that right?
Yes, I had a pre-tenure fellowship in which I had some time to write. And I also had the opportunity to do a bookshop workshop in which I got some feedback from people in a variety of fields, not just 19th century U.S. studies, but people who I thought were smart and who would, be good readers in general of work in American studies, American literature, kind of broadly construed. And kind of ongoing conversations with lots and lots and lots of people outside of UW really allowed me to kind of re-realize this project in ways that were very different from when I started at the outset.
So for listeners who may not have had a chance to get their copy of the book yet, could you give us your synopsis or your elevator pitch of this book, please?
So this is a book about how race works and the ways that narratives of interracial kinship in 19th century U.S. literature show us that people are conceiving of race not simply in terms of biological genealogies passed down from parents to children, but as a construction that is influenced by people's relations beyond those downward genealogies. So relations of sexual kinship, kinship with sexual partners, relations of parents to children are also things that racialize people in the text that I discuss.
And so if we jump into the text, one of the things I love when I'm given a book to do a podcast is the acknowledgments. I always look at who the book is dedicated to, and I look at the acknowledgments. And I was thrilled to find out that you love acknowledgments as much as I do. So if you will indulge me for a moment, I'd love to read a paragraph out of the acknowledgments for listeners. You write, "Whenever I assign an academic monograph in a graduate course, I always ask my students to read the acknowledgments. I tell them that book acknowledgement sections are a reminder that even single-authored academic writing is not done in isolation, but in relation. I explain that reading this section carefully is as important as paying close attention to citational practices. I ask them to consider this genre of genuinely grateful and deeply loving writing as they find their people and work to build and sustain ethical communities of learning, colleagueship, camaraderie, and care. I ask them to remember how family, both biological and non-biological, influences a writer's life and work and helps to shape it, hopefully for the better, whether or not these folks have read or ever will read the works written in their loved ones' books." It goes on from there, but I love that. I feel like it's such a wonderful foundation for the philosophy of the book itself. Can you tell us a little bit about your love of acknowledgments and some of what you put in yours, please?
Well, I started reading acknowledgement sections as a graduate student in a way of, you know, just trying to learn about the field, learning who was in conversation with one another, quite literally. And that was revealing. In acknowledgement sections, you can see who went to grad school together, who is in a writing group together, what people at the same institution are in conversation with one another. You can see friendships. You can see relations beyond academia. And when I started teaching graduate students, and I started teaching monographs in those classes, especially classes on things like race and theory, I made a point to make sure the graduate students in my classes were reading the acknowledgement sections as a mode of not just understanding these texts themselves, but just general professionalization. Here in Wisconsin, my students don't always have the same kind of geographical access to people at other institutions that I had in the Northeast, where universities are just kind of closer together, clustered. I think it's very difficult for students who don't necessarily have a huge community of peers in their same field to understand how that field is operating. I benefited from coming up with a lot of 19th century Americanists, people who were operating in the same general field as I was, in tandem with one another. And we learned collectively through our experiences in that field. And we operated not just individuals, I think, but as a group of people, as junior scholars. My partner is a 19th century Americanist. And so we've been working kind of in tandem in our field for quite some time. And as I started to teach graduate students from lots of different fields and in rather eclectic groups
of students from various departments and with various, emphases, especially students who are working on race, sometimes in predominantly white fields. The importance of learning about actual human relationships became a point of professionalization and a point that I think we really need to be deliberate about when we talk about what is going to be sustaining about this work. And for me, that's always been actual relationships with actual people, not just the people that I'm reading, but people that I know in real life and have had actual human conversations with. And so, I wrote this in the middle of the pandemic semester in which our campus experiences were curtailed. We stopped going to campus. We started meeting virtually. And it was an opportunity to think even more deliberately about what it means to be in physical proximity to one another, in conversation, in relation, because all of those relations were taken to this kind of virtual space in which they had to be even more deliberate. You didn't run into anybody in spaces on campus anymore. I didn't meet with my students in class anymore, where we would pause midway through the period and make tea and chat before we moved on. And so I wrote my acknowledgments, after following my own graduate experience, thinking more deliberately about mentoring the graduate students who I was in conversation with, but also in this moment in which thinking about relation really, really shifted, I think, for me. And in which being as transparent as possible, I think, about the necessity of, being deliberate about relationships in academia was something that we, kind of can't let fall by the wayside, I think. I also wrote this with a lot of support from various community, in which during that pandemic moment, I had to fact check this book and check my citations. And I didn't have that library access. And so sometimes that involved, writing to somebody and saying, look, my copy of your book is in my office, which I can't access. So could you send me a picture of this page so that I can check this quotation? And that happened in conversation with some of the people who I knew, who I was citing. And, I think that this acknowledgement section was really informed by, both that, kind of general professional practice in which I've been thinking about relations in my fields, and also, this moment in which those relationships and conversations had to be sought out in ways that were a bit different in the absence of things like going to campus or going to conferences.
One of the things that I love that you have in the acknowledgments is a section about your parents and about yourself. I'd like to read just a little bit of that. You write, "My parents, Sue Ann Fielder and Stephen Fielder, have never questioned my ability to complete this or any academic project. Their unconditional love and support has been a radical alternative to the various forces that would discourage a Black girl, a first-generation college student, a non-academic worker, a mother, or someone in any other position of academic marginalization I have occupied. These were the first theorizers of race I encountered, and it is perhaps from them that I learned the basic premise of this study, that race is often believed to work in certain ways, but that is not necessarily so." You go on to say that your parents are people who taught you to love to read and to love reading, and that they were the first to put African-American literature into your hands at a time when for about two decades, nobody else was. The acknowledgments in many ways reads to me as the underlying philosophy on which the theories that you then present in the book, where you're taking apart what is race, how do we understand identity, how do we understand kinship, what is and isn't family, who does and doesn't define it, what is a genealogy kind of all comes back to rest on so much of what you have in the acknowledgments.
Yeah. Everybody, I think, says that your research in many ways is often about you. Though certain people's research is kind of, regarded as being about them, and certain people's research is regarded as kind of universalizing in lots of ways. And that falls oftentimes along kind of clear racialized lines. But there's no way in which this book about interracial kinship is not about my own experiences as a mixed race Black woman and relationship to, the various kinds of literature, often understudied literature, that I'm treating here. And in many ways, that's a longer story than the story of my academic professionalization. But other people, I bring, my own experiential expertise to this project in addition to my academic expertise. And that's very, very much informed how I'm doing the work I'm doing here.
In some ways, it goes back to the writing advice, which is write the book that only you could write. And this book seems to incorporate so much of your passions and philosophies and scholarship in such a profoundly unique way. And yet it is very universal. I know for me, my work is also in 19th century American history. This book puts together and names so many unnamed things that I struggled with in my own research. You fill in so many of the gaps and you contextualize and put together theories that help so much make sense that isn't put together anywhere else in the literature. And part of that is your unique ability to bring in queer theory and Black feminist theory. Can you talk about how that helped you decode the literature that you're using in the book?
Yes. I started writing this project thinking of myself as a person who didn't and couldn't do theory. I'd studied, things that people call theory with a capital T in various ways since I was an undergraduate. My bachelor's degree is in philosophy, a very white male dominated field, almost exclusively in the texts that I was taught in that field. In theological and religious studies, my first master's degree, it was pretty much the same in theory courses. At Cornell, in a department kind of known for theory with a capital T, the idea of theory with a capital T has still been overwhelmingly white and male. And so the idea of who could and couldn't do theory, I think is part of some, kind of really problematic ideas that I've absorbed over the course of my education, in which overwhelmingly theory has been, the way I've been presented theory has been only through white male perspectives. And so I came to Black feminist theory in this project in some of the last work that I did in my dissertation project in my early kind of iterations of this, and still thinking about whether that meant that I could really engage with theory was not something that I was at all confident about as I started this out. It really wasn't until my dissertation defense that I kind of had ideas that the ideas of theory that I really kind of ended up with in the project were actually more of a starting point. I also, in my first iteration of this, didn't engage queer theory at all, and came to this body of theory that I had been reading as a graduate student for quite a while, just because queer theory in 19th century U.S. Literary studies is quite strong and interesting. But as I realized that this was where I thought the most interesting critiques of kinship were, the most interesting critiques of time were, as I wrote about genealogy, I realized that that was what I needed in order to write this book. But as I worked towards, you know, making this kind of theoretical intervention, I was very, very hesitant for quite a lot of time with my ability to do work that would have been theoretical, or that I would have called theoretical, or that anyone would have called theoretical. And it's really because of conversations with other people that I changed my mind about that and decided that this was a book that could try to center those kinds of, you know, theoretical conversations, and that allowed me to do things like talk about this book as offering a different theory of racial formation, for example. And, you know, that I think really made this a different kind of book than otherwise I thought it was going to be. I definitely didn't originally think of Duke University Press as a place that I could place my work until I had a conversation with Elizabeth Freeman and Peter Coviello, who encouraged me to send it there. I thought of Duke as a theoretical press, and I very much enjoyed reading books from there, but didn't think that this was the kind of work that I could do or would be doing. And so, you know, that really helped me to just kind of change my perspective of you know, my work as a scholar and of, you know, what I think this book needed to do or needed to be or needed to incorporate in order to explain the phenomenon that I was trying to explain.
And the phenomenon that you're trying to explain is that race is constructed, socially constructed, and socially reproduced.
Yeah, I mean, and I think also the how, right? So, you know, we know that race is constructed. And, you know, I think students, when you talk to them about race, will tell you like, yeah, race is a social construction. It's not really biological. But in, social conversations about race, people still talk about it in distinctly biological terms. That often has to do with things about genealogy. And the idea of race as inheritable. But I realized that, you know, the primary ways that we understand race as being inheritable in the United States are also very largely dependent upon these odd theoretical constructions of race. They, you know, they're, you know, like racism, race isn't quite logical. It doesn't always do the things that we expect it to do. And this is one of the ways that, one of the things that tells us, you know, that it's constructed. And even the theory of hypodescent, that is, you know, probably the predominant understanding of race in the United States, the one drop rule that determines blackness, right? Really doesn't follow these ideas about biological inheritance, you know, that would otherwise trace genealogy, you know, quite differently, but that selective genealogy for racialization was one kind of key point that showed us not just that race was constructed, but how, that it's constructed via relations, but in ways that are selective oftentimes.
And so to get at the how, you give us several case studies that you take from history, from literature, from a famous play, from a number of sources. And I think one of the examples that ties right into where we are in this conversation is chapter 2, Almost Eliza. Could you tell us about this particular couple and the complexity of it not being illegal for them to get married in New York, and yet it being virtually impossible for them to safely and happily do so?
Right. Great. Yeah. So New York State, the state I'm from, is one of really a handful of states that never had any what are called anti-miscegenation laws preventing interracial marriage. And these vary kind of widely across states. They always have to do with specific groups of people in the population that white people can't legally marry. They change over time. And those laws aren't outlawed until the 1967 Supreme Court case Loving v. Virginia. But New York never had these laws. And so it was legal for Black and white people to get married, though it was not socially acceptable in the mid-19th century, as anybody can imagine. So a lot of interesting anti-slavery history in New York State. And one really interesting, I think, case that comes out of, anti-slavery history is New York Central College, a co-educational, racially integrated college in upstate New York that was rather short-lived, but at which William Allen, a mixed-race Black man, taught, who was a classics professor, in which Mary King, the white daughter of abolitionists, attended. And so this couple gets married. There's a lot of opposition to their marriage from their community in Fulton, New York, which is very close to where I'm from. They have support from their some of their friends. They eventually elope and they leave the country. And from what we know, they don't come back. William Allen writes a narrative of this experience called The American Prejudice Against Color. It's published in 1853. It's published abroad. It's not published in the United States, but, news of their marriage circulates in the Black press. They're people who are known in various ways. And in this narrative, he tells us his version of events, but he also publishes some newspaper accounts of things like this white mob that attempts to, that actually takes Mary King back to her father's house. And some of her family seems very opposed to this marriage, but some of her family doesn't and seems to be supporting them. He gives these reproductions of things from white racist newspapers. He also reproduces some letters from both Mary King and from some of their friends. And he gives his own version of these events. And in one of these letters from a friend of theirs compares her to Eliza Harris, the mixed race heroine of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. And they're talking about the fact that the couple is going to leave. They're going to elope and leave the country. And he writes, your flight is a flight for freedom, and I can almost call you Eliza, something to that extent. I'm reading this, this story, which is really, really interesting to me for a lot of reasons. But this point kind of stood out, this white woman, in this whole kerfuffle depends upon the whiteness of this woman. This is the reason that everybody is upset about this. But then these anti-slavery friends of theirs, compare her to this mixed race heroine in Uncle Tom's Cabin. I was interested in what's going on with that. What does it mean to read this white woman as though in the genre of a mixed race heroine? And here genre became, kind of one way in which race is read. If you didn't know the race of this woman and you were reading about, these people who have to flee the country because of this racist mob that would put their family at risk, it would be easy to read her not as a white person, but to read her as, one of these, popular heroines of anti-slavery fiction, for example. Thinking about how reading race and reading genre kind of align became a very useful mechanism for kind of talking about what we do when we construct race. How we read according to scripts that we think are kind of familiar, how we, make comparisons across texts or resemblances. This case, I think, gives us a little bit of a grounding for some of the rest of the book to understand, how reading practices and racial construction kind of happen in these texts that are about race, and also in which people think about reading race through bodies who maybe do or maybe don't evidence racialization in the ways that are usual.
And you talk about this mob that shows up as having this mindset that they were there to rescue her. And you compare that to another text where a white woman was living with Native Americans. Can you talk more about this idea that these white women have to be saved by angry mobs?
Yeah. So, so a lot of, anti-miscegenation marriage law and rhetoric about, a lot of racist rhetoric employs white women as a kind of white supremacist prop. The idea that white women must be protected from Black men, right? Or the idea that white women must be protected from Native men is a kind of common trope. And the thing is that while historically white women have often been complicit in this, this project of this particular white supremacist project, that complicity is not necessary. And they haven't always been. And so those exceptions, kind of show the farce of these claims of protection. So there were, for example, white women who, lived as captives in Native communities, but who resisted being reclaimed for white society. And I talk about Mary Jemison, for example, in the fifth chapter. Narrative of the Life of Mary Jemison is, a story in which a woman, is captured, but then she is adopted into a different tribe. She becomes Seneca in this context in which, being Seneca is not a matter of biology, but a matter of behavioral kinship. And that community recognizes her as a full member. She has she marries, she has children, and she is uninterested in being redeemed as white women captives were. And so the rhetoric around Mary King is kind of similar to this idea that white women require redemption. All of these accounts of Mary King paint her very, very differently from William Allen and all of their friends and her own letters. And so painting this woman as a damsel in need of protection, as a captive who needs saving, which is what a lot of these newspaper accounts are doing, has to do a lot of work to refuse this woman's own agency, to refuse her ability to make her own, sexual decisions. They have to, defy even her own accounts of this. And so, reading these things, we get very, very different characters that were read here. So these people are reading her as though she is Eliza from Uncle Tom's Cabin. These racist newspaper accounts are reading her as this damsel who has been kidnapped and who needs to be saved and who needs to be returned to her father's house. But in reality, they do all of this by force and against this woman's will. And she is, talks about being a captive of, the white people who are preventing her marriage freedom. So we have these very, very different accounts of what's going on here that are recognizable because they mirror certain literary genres in which we see this. And so reading her as the tradition of the captivity narrative creates a familiar enough story that readers of the racist press probably recognize that as a kind of story that they'd seen before, even while that story had to ignore The reality of, anything this person herself would have said or done.
You talk in the book about how race is a social construction, and about how kinship models can deconstruct whiteness. In the example of Mary Jemison, by living with the Senecas and through kinship becoming Seneca and having children and marrying, she's by white society standards no longer white. And sort of at the core of the white mob mentalities that are coming out is this anxiety over that whiteness is precarious. Mm-hmm. And those are things that you grapple with quite a lot in chapter 6. Can you talk about how these two cases in particular help illustrate that white anxiety over the tenuousness of whiteness and why kinship itself is threatening to that, but also what you propose as incredibly important, the importance of looking at kinship models and what it can mean for how we move forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, one interesting question is, why do white supremacists care so much about interracial marriage as a thing that they want to prevent? And this, I think, suggests something revealing about the construction of race, right? If, the idea that race is precarious, and that whiteness especially is precarious because of these, this construction of hypo descent that, that any amount of a blackness, for example, would make somebody black. The argument against interracial marriage for white supremacists is that, this will lead to the literal non-existence of white people, right? This is something that we see in this rhetoric, in this racist text that I read from the 1830s, Jerome Holgate's Sojourn in the City of Amalgamation. It's something that we see in contemporary contexts when people talk about something like white genocide. But what it really reveals, I think, is a lot about the construction of whiteness as well. That whiteness, it is something that gets framed in these ways, especially through white women who are the people who are tasked kind of with the project of reproducing whiteness in a way that is very, very skewed in terms of gendering.
And it's very circular, you say in the book.
Yeah. White women reproduce, the white family that will reproduce the white nation, that will reproduce white people who will reproduce the white family. It's interesting how these implications shift to different scales that, always kind of loop back on one another.
And kinship breaks the circle.
Yeah, well, kinship becomes, I think, the kind of pivot point, right, for any of this construction, right? How we understand race being reproduced has to do with the literal reproduction of people. And those relationships between differently racialized people inform how race gets produced. And that is not always in, these discrete, easily identifiable racialized boxes. But a lot of the time it messes up those categories in ways that become a problem for people who are invested in preserving whiteness especially.
And you talk about a 19th century writer who wants to mess this up, Lydia Maria Child's book, where she's talking about racial mixing as natural, and she writes a book about a novel with these themes in it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Lydia Maria Child's Romance of the Republic is a Civil War novel published in 1867. And it's in the, the genre of mixed race heroine fiction in which we have these women who did not know that they were mixed race Black women, but find out later, and they go on to actually marry white men and reproduce, this kind of amalgamated nation in a way that becomes quite controversial. Lydia Maria Child is kind of known for, having, controversial views. She's not opposed to interracial marriage, for example, which a lot of abolitionists, a lot of white abolitionists distanced themselves from in this, kind of anxiety that like people who wanted to abolish slavery would also want to integrate the races both in social spaces and to allow interracial marriage. And so because a lot of white abolitionists were pretty clearly also white supremacists, oftentimes they would distance themselves from this idea, we're abolitionists, but we are definitely not amalgamationists. But Lydia Maria Child is kind of clearly an amalgamationist. But she does this in a way that is, that still gives us this very, white looking, light skinned Black women characters who are very different from, the other Black people in the novel and don't necessarily identify with them because they are raised as white women. The picture that she gives us of the end of Romance of the Republic is just a picture of a post-war amalgamated nation in which Black people are incorporated into the kind of American national family in the same vein as various white European people. And these things are all kind of, mixed together within the same family of these two women at the center of this novel. And naturalized. These women's names are Flora and Rosa. They're flowers. This is all, kind of very clearly put in opposition to, racist arguments that racial amalgamation was inherently unnatural and and scientific racism that talked about things like racial degeneration or something like that. But Lydia Maria Child is still giving a kind of assimilationist approach to race that has some pretty clear problems, but is also in a kind of stark defiance to certain kinds of scientific racism that are still going to be circulating by the time she writes this in the late 19th century.
And you remind us again and again in the book that people who were anti-slavery could not be assumed, nor should we correctly believe that they were anti-racist. You give us examples from Lincoln's own speeches. We see it in the Quaker community of this woman who's not providing her the support that we would assume they would if they were in fact both anti-slavery and anti-racist, because they weren't both. And this theme goes throughout the book to remind us again and again that it's two separate things and that anti-racism is far more difficult to bring about because it's far more difficult to legislate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I mean, so, you do have a number of kind of, legal points, that are in operation here, like things like marriage law, for example, is one, but, like the case of William Allen and Mary King, things can be legal and still, these people, while their marriage is legal, they're not safe, in this place. They're not welcomed, among a lot of King's family. And they, decide that this is not a country that they want to live in. There's also, various things that make them precarious, vis-a-vis slavery, right? What, you know, in a world in which all Black people are at least in some danger of enslavement, right? When we have things like the Fugitive Slave Law, you know, the question of the safety of her children, even though those children are technically born born free and, you know, unenslavable as children of a white woman, you know, we know that people are kidnapped, and this, you know, and these children might look visibly Black enough that they don't pass for white. And, you know, we can see, you know, how this would be a dangerous situation for them.
And in chapter six, you urge us towards a genealogical future that does not reproduce white supremacy, but towards a more racially inclusive future, a future that will necessitate kinship with those who are Black and brown and indigenous and queer. In the few minutes we have left, can you talk more about that?
Well, I ended this this book by kind of thinking, you know, kind of closing the circle of thinking about these, you know, larger scales and stakes of racial mixture. And I wanted to think about, you know, the larger racial, you know, teleologies of reproduction, especially those that I discuss in the middle couple of chapters in the book, that are in many ways about Black women's reproduction of Blackness as something that isn't necessarily thwarted by the foreclosing of kinship that enslavement is seeking to enact, but that has a genealogical scope that goes beyond them, that is necessarily teleological, pointing towards, you know, the perpetuation of Black people into a future that is, you know, framed in various legal ways as perpetuating the system of slavery in which people follow the condition of their mother, but in which that future teleology is imposed. It's not the necessary teleology that's happening there. And so, you know, I end the book with a coda that conclusion that thinks about Toni Morrison's 2008 novel, A Mercy, which I think gives us a really interesting kind of theorization of interracial kinship and how something like interracial sisterhood is foreclosed historically for the characters that she describes. Because this white genealogy tends towards white supremacy in its racial production, it doesn't necessarily seek to make some kind of radical, you know, racial inclusion. And you know, I was interested in how that failure of interracial kinship, you know, shows us this more usual framing than many of the texts that I discuss. That are exceptional in that they're not they show us ways that race works in unusual ways, but they reveal that the kind of white supremacist teleology that Morrison leaves us with in A Mercy is not inevitable. It's not a necessary teleology, but a choice. You know, that these people are that you know, the white woman at the center of that part of the narrative is kind of making, you know, that this gets foreclosed, but that foreclosure is deliberate, and it's not inevitable. And it could have been otherwise, even while we understand historically, you know, how this story is going to play out.
What do you hope this book sparks for listeners and for readers?
I mean, I guess, one of my biggest takeaways, I think, here is this question of the non-necessity of racist teleologies, that, you know, even though we can understand historically how, logics of racial essentialism, how logics of, white supremacy, and racial segregationalism have, kind of played out, and how those appear in U.S. literature and culture, from the 18th century through to the present, to kind of understand these teleologies that are otherwise, as things that kind of always linger as possibilities, even in any of these previous moments, and that these kind of show us the non-necessity of the kind of usual preservation of white supremacy, the kind of usual rendering of kinlessness that slavery worked to enact upon Black families, that while these things are historically true and historically predictable, maybe, that they weren't inevitable. There are always choices that people made, or they could have been otherwise. And so I think kind of tracing the way that these racial genealogies are working in throughout these different 19th century texts through to the way people continue to talk about race in often essentializing ways that are still tied up in a lot of the same anxieties about racial essentialism and especially preserving whiteness, that these, can't simply be understood as like inevitable for their time or completely logical, but that these other, but that because race is constructed, because the various forces of racism that are also kind of operating in these constructions of race, make us understand, the workings of race in the present, especially that oftentimes look very, very familiar to 19th century contexts for me, to see that these things could have always been otherwise, that other futures were always possible and still are possible. And that doesn't necessarily, lead to the erasure of race, but a different framing of how race's resonance is working, right? That and how we understand for example white feminism's historical failures of kinship with white people, a kind of huge topic for thinking, I think, about contemporary politics in the United States. That those two, were never historically inevitable, but did work differently in different kinds of texts, both fictional and nonfictional, and could be framed otherwise. And that's still, I think, a possibility.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Dr. Fielder, and telling us about you. Oh, you're welcome. I really appreciate this conversation so much. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. You've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. please join us again.